lot of people around my way who definitely have got long COVID are being given antidepressants. They're being told that it's depression. There's no link made with the fact that they had COVID 3 months ago.
Jane has a specialist interest in supporting clients with long COVID, or post-COVID syndrome as it's also referred. And today I'm going to be talking to her about her experience of supporting clients with long COVID. Jane, welcome to the Human Givens podcast. It's so good to have you with us today.
I'm very pleased to be here.
So I'm really interested today. We've had a chat previously, but just really interested to hear a bit more from you about where your interest first started with working with long COVID clients.
Yeah, I think I have an interest because back in the late 80s, early 90s, I developed this thing called yuppie flu. I was one of the lucky ones in the fact that my GP was very, well, I suppose it was not only sympathetic, but he had the latest data and then referred me to a consultant. They both diagnosed me with ME, or chronic fatigue syndrome. Very nicely said, well, there's no cure for it, you'll just have to muddle along as best you can. And so, having sort of struggled for 8 years with the symptoms of, you know, muscle fatigue, chronic fatigue, and all the things that go with it, when long COVID came up, it was like, oh, this is what I had. But luckily today we have a lot more, there's a lot more research. I think it's because it was more profound, there were more people. And my experience was, I knew, I was nursing at the time, there were three nurses on my ward who had, you know, diagnosed with ME. Mm. So it's not something that has never been around before. It's just that we've got a different name for it.
Mm. Mm. So I wonder then if we can learn from the research that's being done around long COVID, whether we can learn more about how we might work with ME and chronic fatigue as well.
Yeah, I think there are kind of many areas, if you like, to work with people. Kind of thinking about my own experience, I think what would have helped me was learning how to relax. You know, this is a, if you like, one of the Human Givens causes about lowering emotional arousal and learning how to pace. You know, mm-hmm. These are things where getting your needs met is really important. And if you don't get your needs met, then you are left in psychological and physiological stress. And stress is a very big causative factor for feeling tired.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, some of the physical symptoms of long COVID are perhaps a little bit more obvious. But, you know, along with stress and tiredness, what other sorts of things do clients present to you in therapy? Because I know that you have worked with a number of people with long COVID.
I've worked with a few, and with people with chronic fatigue, you know, not long COVID. I think one of the biggest things that people talk about is hitting the wall, you know, that overwhelming tiredness. But the biggest one is brain fog, not being able to think clearly, not being able to focus and concentrate. So the two seem to kind of coexist. Is if you get physically too tired, you then lose your capacity for clear thinking. So, you know, that the brain fog, it kind of just, it doesn't seem to kind of come down slowly. It's like hitting a brick wall. One minute you can think and the next minute you've got a brain full of porridge.
And so working to lower the emotional arousal presumably really helps with that.
I would say from my own personal experience is once I had learnt how to become calmer, to de-arouse, if you like, to get more into my parasympathetic nervous system, once I'd learned how to do that, symptoms became much more manageable.
And did you find that with the physical symptoms as well?
Yeah, it's a hand-in-hand thing, isn't it? It's the physical and the psychological, the physical, they're all interlinked. You can't kind of pull one away from the other.
Yeah. So you said that obviously a presentation in your therapy room might be people coming in feeling very, very stressed and perhaps distressed about the physical symptoms they're feeling, but also, you know, this awful experience of brain fog. I know when we talked previously, you said there was quite an interesting element of how somebody's stress levels were before they actually got COVID as a predictor in how they experienced long COVID afterwards.
Yeah, this is kind of one of my observations, if you like. Personally, my stress levels before I got my, before I became ill with, I got a virus, it would have been one of the COVID viruses. Before I became ill, my stress levels were through the roof. And this is an observation I've made with a lot of clients who presented with chronic fatigue, whether it's long COVID or from another source, is that they were very stressed before they got ill. And of course, if you're very stressed before you get ill, your immune system is not functioning properly. So you're more likely to get a kind of an overreaction, a kind of a hyper, it's like a hyper immune response.
Is that what people might term that viral load impacting on the functioning of the immune system?
The viral load is the amount of virus that you have in your system.
Right.
But it's the way that your immune system reacts to the viral load. So some people, so we're not supposed to go, what were they calling it? The cytokine storm. So a lot of the deaths from COVID were actually because of the cytokine storm, where the immune system went absolutely totally crazy.
Right.
So our immune system is supposed to keep it in balance. And when your immune system goes, it goes sort of like you get a hyperimmune response. That I think is when there is a lot more damage done.
And obviously, you know, this is not a paper or any, you know, research based at all, but it's, you know, your observations within your own practice. And, you know, hugely beneficial to people listening to understand what people might present with and how we might work with it. But I know when you've talked previously about this cytokine storm and the immune system doing too much. So when the immune system's overactive, if you like, what sorts of things were people experiencing?
I think that's when people started to become very short of breath, because it causes inflammation through the whole system. So part of the immune response is an inflammatory response. But if we take that with somebody being kind of physiologically stressed because of life experience, they're already having an inflammatory response. So if you add a virus to that, it kind of makes it worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of the problems with COVID was because of kind of having an overt inflammatory response in the body.
To a body that was already
To a body that was already stressed. So if you've got, you know, if you say, what was it that just came out in that latest report, is the people who are more prone to long COVID are women, smokers, and people with a comorbidity. And what just flashed through my mind is a lot of women are juggling a lot of things. This is just a question I'm asking myself and anyone else is, are women more stressed? Do women have a higher stress load? Is that one of the reasons, as well as, you know, sort of hormones, why women might be more prone to getting long COVID?
Absolutely. Gosh, Jane, I think we could do a whole other podcast on that, couldn't we? But absolutely. And I think that's a really interesting thing that's come out there about, we saw that this morning, didn't we, come through, that the people who are presenting or most likely to present with long COVID are women, smokers, and those with a comorbidity such as diabetes, asthma and heart disease. So, you know, their body and potentially their minds are already seeming to be under a lot of stress before they get
a lot of stress. Yeah.
And so it makes sense then that teaching that relaxation, helping to turn that down, to lower that emotional arousal, can have that knock on benefit.
I would think it would have, you know, sort of thinking of my own recovery, it was once some of the layers of stress in my life had disappeared, or that I had started doing things like meditation. I had encountered the human givens, but I don't think I'd started my training. But I started to do like breathing exercises and mindfulness. And that's when it was quite a profound recovery. So I kind of redressed the stress balance. That was my own experience. I can't say that it will be like that for everybody, but for me, it was dealing with the stress, getting my autonomic nervous system back into balance was a big part of recovery.
Absolutely. I mean, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? That we know that so many physical health problems can be exacerbated if you know, our emotional arousal is high, if our sympathetic system is switched on. And, you know, when we move more into the rest and digest, and our bodies are given that chance. And obviously that's going to have a huge knock-on effect on sleep as well. If we're able to dial down that emotional arousal, we're going to promote better sleep, which is obviously where the body's repairing itself. So you talked about the breathlessness that people experience. And I was speaking to somebody last week who themselves was experiencing long COVID, and we were talking about 7-11 breathing, and they really, really struggle with 7-11 breathing. And it's not something that they find easy. And could you talk a little bit more about what happens with the breathlessness, how it comes about, why people get breathless, and how you might be able to work with that?
I think there was this, it's a kind of, as far as I'm aware, and I'm not a doctor, I am observer and I'm a nurse, but there are two areas. One is the inflammation, where the tissues of the lungs become inflamed, and they become, if you're almost like waterlogged, like a sponge, which means that you're not absorbing as much oxygen. That's one point, but that's, if you like, in the acute phase. And then you had what were called microclots during the more chronic phase. So some people would become very breathless initially because their lungs have become like wet sponges, so you can't get the oxygen in. And then later on remained breathless, but that was because there were little clots, and that stops the lungs from, you know, sort of absorbing, you know, so if the little clots in the capillaries stop the oxygen from being absorbed. So it's a kind of two-pronged approach. So they were using steroids to reduce the inflammation in the lungs, and then it would be using blood thinners. So a lot of people will put on blood thinners. So they weren't like the bad clots. They were little tiny clots. So breathing, I mean, it's an essential part of life. And I know trying to teach 7-11 breathing to, you know, to people with asthma, they find it really difficult because they can't take in a big breath. Well, they can, but I think sometimes you feel too tight and it's too scary. So I guess it would be finding other ways of increasing the out-breath just minimally, isn't it? I mean, we know that physiologically, as long as the out-breath is a couple of seconds longer than the in-breath, then that will start to take an effect on kind of redressing that balance and getting us into rest and digest. I just suddenly thought of that thing that kids do, you know, that one where you blow on your finger, where you don't have to take a massive breath in, you don't have to hold it, you just breathe in, and then you blow on your finger, which is a way of getting small children to kind of use the kind of 7-11 approach.
Yeah. So, you know, it might be for somebody who's found it very difficult because of the long COVID breathlessness that they're experiencing. And you hit the nail on the head there. Sometimes it can feel quite frightening. For people, if they take that breath and they suddenly feel that actually there's not much space there, and it, you know, it might, for them, there might be a pattern match perhaps as well, back to when they were unwell maybe. So just taking it down really, really small, and perhaps, you know, using something like in for three and out for five, like we do with children, even just, you know, whatever they can do, and whatever feels comfortable for them, and just employing that principle of just making the out breath half as
just
long,
just that
again,
little bit longer. I think it's sometimes when you do that psychoeducation and you teach somebody about, you know, the roles of the in-breath and the out-breath, is once they know why they're doing it, then they can find their own way around. So I remember trying to teach this to a lady with quite severe asthma. She got the principles, but when we were trying to do 7-11 or even 3-5, she couldn't do it. But several weeks she came back and said, I've got it. I've got my own way of doing it. So I think the psychoeducation part is really important. It's explaining what we're doing and why we're doing it. And that allows somebody to, you know, gives them a sense of autonomy and control, doesn't it?
And that, you know, such a fundamental part of human givens is drawing it back to meeting those needs. And I think perhaps for people experiencing long COVID, you know, there can be that sense of uncertainty, can't there, as to when am I going to feel better?
And it's from people that I've worked with, it's so scary. When am I going to be normal? Am I ever going to be normal?
So helping them have a sense of control over that and volition in the way that they're practicing that breath work. And I think that's, you know, there was something you said there about the psychoeducation. And what I think, you know, in my experience, I've just seen as so important is that people understand. It's not that they know what to do, it's that they understand why they're doing it.
Then
they can find a way that works for them.
And I think a lot of, you know, I had a young lady from CAMHS going slightly off-piste who had been taught breathing exercises, which she didn't do because she wasn't told why. Yeah. Once I'd explained to her why, she went, well, if they'd have told me that, I would have done them. Yeah. So, as human givens practitioners, we have that strong psychoeducation element of informing our clients why are we doing this.
Absolutely. We're adding to the resources they've got. You know, it's another tool in the toolbox, isn't it, then?
It's such a big tool, isn't it? Breath is a small thing, but it's a massive tool. You know, it can help us, you know, sort of control anxiety, get out of a panic attack, you know, lower emotional arousal.
So it sounds like, you know, you were talking about some of the medical interventions around breathing. Obviously, you know, there will be some people who do need that medical support for their breathing as well. And in some cases, you know, I know that a friend of mine's an OT, and she's done quite a lot of work with long COVID patients in that rehabilitation process too. So as a human givens therapist, then you could really function as part of that multidisciplinary team, as it were, alongside the medical intervention and perhaps the occupational therapy intervention as well, in terms of the psychological support. And adding to those, you know, those resources to foster that sense of autonomy.
Yeah. And I think sometimes it helps people to, I'm thinking of one client I work with long COVID, who was very loath to get involved with other disciplines, I think because he didn't quite understand.
Right.
And through kind of explaining to him what they might be going to do made him more likely to participate, you know. So again, it was about a sense of autonomy that he could then choose. I think his doctor was trying to do the best for him, but he was like, I don't know what this is all about. I don't think I want to engage in this, you know. And then he did, you know, because he didn't quite understand. You know, I think we should be part of, you know, the team, if you like. Yeah. If the team accepts us,
Okay, so from you know the point of view of other professionals involved in somebody's care and rehabilitation, that acceptance of the therapeutic support as well, is what you mean.
And I think that's patchy, isn't it? Because there are some areas that encourage, you know, psychological support, and there are others who seem to, well, diminish its efficacy, and yet we're all working on the same system. We're working with a human being who's not just about a body or a brain, you know.
Yeah, we've got a shared goal, but maybe slightly different models of reality. To get there. So I wonder, you know, about, obviously some people are more open to it than others, but having that open conversation, you know, and getting permission from the client, can I speak with your GP? Would it be okay for me to email your GP to explain, you know, the work that we've been doing together? Because I think sometimes there's that lack of understanding of, you know, what can a counsellor or a therapist do?
Yeah.
With understanding of, you know, the organising idea and the approach. In terms of the brain fog, obviously there's the emotional arousal element, but are there any factors that come into play with the brain fog?
This is, you know, the theory that I was discussing with you yesterday. This is my own theory, but it is based on fact. So I read recently that glutamate, so that's one of the neurotransmitters in the brain, has multiple functions, but it increases when we are trying to focus on something. And right. What happens is that when we're focusing, let's say you're in a lecture or something and you're trying to focus on, you know, something, and then suddenly you find that you're looking out the window, and glutamate will come to a threshold, and then your brain just switches off and says, I've got to clear all of this glutamate. And so my own personal theory is that when somebody has brain fog, what you're trying to do is focus, aren't you? So your brain is producing glutamate and you hit that threshold much earlier, which means that, you know, your brain just shuts down. That's my theory.
That's a really interesting theory. It kind of ties in with one of the 13 principles we teach in the Human Givens Diploma, and it, you know, really ties in with the reversal effect, doesn't it? That the more you try to focus on something that you would just usually do automatically, the more difficult it becomes to do. Yeah. And, you know, I wonder whether there's that link there with that glutamate rise.
Do you know, kind of thinking about it, I think that there is, if you like, there is a physiological and neurological rationale why that happens, is that the more you try to focus, the more glutamate you're producing. Mm. And then you hit that threshold really quickly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's really interesting. So you've talked about the stress levels that come in that to your room with it. How is this affecting people on an emotional level, you know, in your experience, what you've seen?
Well, I do know a lot of people, I've had a few through Frontline 19, and they have been seriously depressed, anxious, you know, because their life has just changed overnight. And when you can't do something that you used to be able to do, I think it personally, that was the biggest thing for me, is not being able to go out for a walk. 10 minutes would just cripple me. And so you're constantly comparing how I used to be with how I am now. And that's very stressful. And then you get that kind of negative voice in your head going, you know, you're useless, can't do anything. Yeah. Will I ever get back to work?
So many needs not being met.
Hugely.
Feeling unwell.
Because, I mean, if you've got long COVID, if you've got chronic fatigue, just normal things like socializing are so incredibly difficult. So your need for attention becomes very, very hard. You know, you don't feel like you are part of a community. The isolation is awful. There are ways around it, but yeah, I mean, it does, thinking back to when I had chronic fatigue really badly, if I did a needs audit then, it would probably be about a one on everything. You know, it was just, you know, couldn't sleep, didn't eat well, couldn't go out, didn't meet anybody, you know, didn't feel like I was a part of anything. Attention needs were not met because I was on my own. It was bad. Yeah. And of course, when your needs are not met, then you become anxious and depressed.
Got that foggy thinking, that brain fog, that's really going to impact on your sense of competence, isn't it? You know, because if you're experiencing prolonged brain fog, then you can't focus, you can't concentrate.
No.
And everyday things that you might have once done just very easily become quite laborious to do and quite challenging. Yeah. And that's horrifying for people.
Yeah. And that's sort of when you're used to being able to find a solution. I would say I'm a very solution focused individual, that all you can see is the problem because your brain doesn't function to help you find a solution. And that, I think, is where talking to a human givens therapist can help, because we are solution focused. It's about finding a way out, isn't it? Mm. And if you can't do it on your own, sometimes it's good to use somebody else's brain.
And, you know, and I know, as you said before, the mind can have such a profound effect on the body, can't it?
So yeah.
When you're working with clients in this way, what is it particularly about working through the human givens organizing idea, if you like, that stands out as being particularly helpful?
Well, first and foremost, we have the needs audit, so you can pinpoint areas. So that is, I think, so important, that we have you know, the use of psychoeducation, you know, where you can educate somebody so they start to understand their own condition. I mean, you know, with some people, just teaching them the 7-11 breathing and why we do it brings the arousal down, which means that if you've got a bit of brain fog, you actually get a bit more space when you're a bit calmer and you're not worried about when am I going to go back to work. And so, and then using guided imagery with people, that kind of relaxes them even more, brings the arousal down, and just gives them an even bigger space to think with.
Yeah. And of course, all of that is building hope for a client who may well
absolutely
have come in.
Absolutely. You know, it's I think one of the biggest things is, if you can't see your way out, you're in a dark cloud, or it's like being in a fog, actually, not just a brain fog. It's like being in a, I used to describe it like it was like moving through treacle. It, hope is just the biggest thing. And using the guided imagery to give hope, you know, that there is hope out there, that you will get back, you know, and some obstacles can be psychological as well as physical.
And so it's that, you know, that scaffolded support, really, isn't it? That using the psychological support really to go hand in hand with the physical recovery as well. And
I was going to say, and maybe rehearsing things that you might not have done, you know, before. That, I think, is very important for some people who are very resistant to change, is that you can get them to practice making a change in the imagination, because as we know, the brain makes no difference, it doesn't differentiate between reality and imagination. So, you know, it's about, you can prime people for a change of behavior without them actually initially trying to do it, because I find that some people they're very like, I can't do this, you know, I'm not going to do that.
So being able to rehearse, and presumably you know you can rehearse out of guided imagery, but you'd be using the guided imagery as a rehearsal space for those changes.
You could use it as a rehearsal space. I think for some people react better, don't they? They accept it more easily when it's given, if you like, under the radar. And other people are quite happy to discuss, you know, different behaviour. I think you have to judge your clients.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. And really what you're doing in that rehearsal, whether you're using guided imagery to do it, or whether you're getting a client to talk you through how they might implement those changes, what you're doing is really laying down that map, that blueprint for them to follow once they've gone outside, you know, because if we can't imagine ourselves doing something, we're unlikely to be able to complete it in the real world. So having that rehearsal gives the roadmap for them to be able to do that in their own lives. And ultimately, that's what you're doing, isn't it? You're working with somebody so that they can go off and live their life on their own without you having to guide them through something.
Absolutely. It just reminded me of a client who had long COVID and rheumatoid arthritis. She had been a paramedic and was finding it really difficult. And it was so obvious to me that what she needed was a wheelchair, but she was very loath to use it. So I didn't use guided imagery, but we kind of discussed the use of a wheelchair, you know, what it would be like, to kind of, like you say, to set that blueprint so that she could see there was an alternative way of being. And the last time, well, we're not working together anymore, but she had actually kind of asked for, you know, through occupational health, asked to have a wheelchair to use around her house.
Fantastic.
And I could see that would make a massive difference, because she wouldn't have to keep walking everywhere. It was her knees and ankles that were bad, and her level of fatigue.
Yeah, which obviously was going to be exacerbated if she's trying to do too much.
Yeah, trying to stand, trying to do too much. I mean, sometimes, you know, it's overcoming those psychological obstacles that will help somebody. And sometimes we can see a little bit more clearly. But then, of course, it's not foisting our idea onto our client, is it? It's about the collaborative working. It's the kind of let's get our two brains together. And we have to be very sensitive, I think, as therapists, of not pushing our ideals onto somebody else.
Absolutely. And so within, you know, working from the HG approach, obviously, you know, you're working to help the client to meet their needs in a healthy way. You're using, you know, language and techniques to help to build hope so that the client can, you know, imagine a different future. helping the client to imagine a different future so that they can feel more positive and they can see that there actually are alternatives in front of them, as you did with the you know, the paramedic and the wheelchair, that was actually, you know, going to make her life that little bit more easy and accessible. So we're accessing the resources that they've already got, and we're adding resources in for them. And sometimes we set tasks as well, don't we? And I know we talked yesterday about task setting or homework, as some people call it. You know, you talked to me about a technique that you use that, although you've trained in it, you know, from somewhere else, absolutely is so applicable within the human given setting. And that was something that you termed pacing. And obviously we know pacing, trained in HG, we know pacing is something else when we're talking about body language, but this was something very different. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that.
We talk about, the pacing and leading is what was so pacing in. When I was unwell with chronic fatigue, people used to say to me, you need to pace yourself more. And I didn't know really what they meant. But what I was doing is when I felt good, I would go hell for leather and then I'd hit a wall and then I had to take 3 or 4 days to recover. And what they call it is called boom and bust. And it's pacing is about, if you like, measuring out your energy so that you don't use it up in one great lump and then take days or weeks for some people to recover. I think pacing's been around for a while. It's the Breathworks. It's been, refined by an organization called Breathworks. So you would monitor, you would take a diary of activities through a week, they say. And then you notice when you start to feel tired or pain. And then you take a shorter amount. So they say about 20%. So let's say that being on your feet, you can be on your feet and you're okay for about, let's say, 20 minutes. What you would then do to pace would be to, like, you would set an alarm on your phone so that you would be on your feet for 15 minutes and then you would sit down for possibly 10, so that you are managing your energy levels. And it works. It works. I've used it in a number of situations and I've taught it to clients as well. So that you're not kind of constantly kind of, when you have energy, it's kind of, let's go and do it and then recover. And then you spend, you know, like you might have, let's say, 3 hours of going for a brisk walk and then it takes you 3 days to recover. So by using pacing, instead of going for a brisk walk, you'd probably have a gentle amble for 20 minutes and then go home and rest, which means that the following day you can have another gentle amble for 20 minutes. So it's about, so when you have chronic fatigue, wherever it comes from, or you have chronic pain, your energy levels are limited. So it's about, instead of using them all up in one short, sharp burst, it's about kind of spreading them out and taking lots of rest.
That makes so much sense. So it's finding your limits really and working at your level wherever that is and not comparing
wherever
yourself.
That is and it changes and you can review it. You know, I went through it. I had a period of ill health over the summer and I used pacing so that I didn't go into this boom and bust, so I could manage, let's say, 10 minutes standing up and then 10 minutes sitting down. I got so much done just by 10 and 10. You know, I didn't have to go to bed, you know, so I would do a task on my phone. I would set it for 10 minutes. As soon as it beeped, I would sit down and then I would rest for 10 minutes. And it was amazing, actually. I got more done over the summer than I do normally because I wasn't floating off.
And it's making me smile because, Jane, you know, you obviously I've spent a lot of time working in universities and you lecture in a university, and you know, don't we use this so often in education? You know, we talk to people about breaking things down, about chunking, about the Pomodoro technique, you know, all of these different things, and actually being able to apply that in, you know, in our own lives with our own bodies. So just listening to you there, it seems to, you know, you're working with clients to really help them to raise their awareness and understand the detailed steps involved in their experience so that they can break that down into achievable goals. So we talk about PAN goals in human givens therapy, that positive, achievable, needs orientated goals, and you're really collaborating with them on that. So it's not your goal, it's that, it's, you know,
yeah,
shared understanding of You know, and like you say, you know, if you can go for a gentle walk for 20 minutes every day, then I think that sense of achievement is going to be much, you know, more readily accessed than if you're going for a 3-hour walk one day and then being wiped out for the rest of the week.
Yeah. And it's because when you have a success, you get that lovely warm glow, don't you? And when you have a failure, then all that negative thinking comes in and you get more stressed, you know, and that you get into that vicious cycle, that downward spiral. Yeah. And it's about persuading people that, you know, if you do it like this now, this is not forever. And I think that is where a lot of people with chronic fatigue have with long COVID is, I'm going to be like this forever. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's kind of saying, well, do you know, it's not going to be forever. I used my friend John of, you know, I had chronic fatigue and this happened and that, but I don't have it now. Mm. You know, that there is light at the end of the tunnel and there are things that you can do that will make that journey quicker and more positive as well. It doesn't have to be. So a lot of people with health conditions, some of them find it very difficult, don't they? And other people are just so amazing. You know, they have a serious health condition, but they live very full lives in little portions.
Yeah.
Bite-sized chunks. A client once said to me is that you can eat an elephant in small bites as long as you have a large enough freezer.
That's definitely one way of putting it. I was just thinking, it just really reminded me of the theory of marginal gains. Is that we're making really small improvements in lots of areas rather than trying to make gigantic improvements in one area. And, you know, we're likely to experience a greater overall improvement if we're using this pacing and this awareness of the limits of where we are within our own body at any one time.
And it's the at this moment, these are my limits, but they're not going to be my limits, you know, in a month's time.
And I think, you know, this at this moment, we're talking about the importance of language, and perhaps when people are suffering with, you know, any physical illnesses as well, and they can't see a light at the end of the tunnel, they might come in with that very sort of, you know, attributional style of permanence about a situation they can't see a way out. And if we're just able to gently reframe with those phrases such as at the moment and yet, that just helps open up that chink of possibility for improvement, doesn't it?
It stops it being the three P's. It's not permanent, it's not pervasive, and it's not permanent, personal. You know, it is at this moment, this is how you are at this moment, but I bet you weren't like that yesterday. You know, it's like we kind of close in on, like, it's really bad now and it's going to be really bad tomorrow. But when you actually have a conversation with somebody, you know, like with mental health issues, is like, well, actually they weren't in the depths of depression, you know, at 4 o'clock yesterday, but they don't remember it.
And I guess some of that in, you know, when you're talking about this, you know, finding limits and observing over a week, some of that will be looking for discrepancy for themselves to be able to see, and maybe using some scaling to see how they felt at any particular time when they were able to do something, what was different, and, you know, perhaps even tying that back into how they'd slept or who they were with, and, you know, the things that they know, the ingredients that they can put in themselves for that recipe for feeling better did in another circumstance perhaps. But I think, just as I'm saying this, all the while really, really underpinning the fact that, you know, we acknowledging the enormity of the impact of this on somebody's life at any one time, because, you know, we certainly wouldn't want to be dismissive of anything. It's about absolutely acknowledging and hearing their story and how it is for them, all the while what's building that hope for change.
For change. And you know, change is inevitable. And that's what I say to clients, change is inevitable. I'm not going to say that's going to get worse, but change is inevitable. And it's not about dismissing their current experience. And I think that's what a lot of doctors do. And it's not very respectful, is it? You know, at the moment somebody might be in a really bad place physically and emotionally. And it's about helping them to find a way out.
Yeah.
It's like being in a maze, isn't it? It's like being stuck in a maze. And what we can do is to help them find their way out of the maze.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lovely, lovely way to put it. And I know you talked about the paramedic that you worked with. And you said you're not working with them anymore. In your experience, within your practice, you know, can people make a full recovery from long COVID?
Some people don't seem to manifest symptoms straight away. They feel a bit unwell, but the symptoms seem to, the male paramedic, he actually went back to work. So he had COVID, he was off for a month, he went back for a month, but the symptoms didn't get really bad until probably 3 months after he had COVID.
Yeah.
They just seemed to get progressively worse. And initially they said it was depression. A lot of people around my way who definitely have got long COVID are being given antidepressants.
Yeah.
They're being told that it's depression. There's no link made with the fact that they had COVID 3 months ago, because some people don't seem to manifest symptoms straight away. They feel a bit unwell. And so the lady I spoke about, she's got other health issues that were compounded by long COVID. Mm-hmm. I think she will make a recovery, but you know, there are other issues there. But there was another paramedic. Of course, if you know, paramedics, very, very stressful job, don't they? Really stressful job. So this gentleman was referred with long COVID. He was really struggling. He wanted to go back to work, but couldn't. You know, there were all the things of the brain fog, and he was pushing himself to do exercise because he'd heard the GP had said, oh, you need to take exercise. And of course, he was going out for a brisk walk, and then that would just floor him for the rest of the day. Yeah. So I taught him a little bit about pacing, about, you know, let's reduce it down a bit. And then he actually expanded that to a lot of areas in his life. And I think on and off, I probably worked with him maybe about 3 months, about 3 months. And he had actually, he'd gone back to work by then. But what he'd learned to do was probably to respect his body a little bit more.
Okay.
It was the boom and bust cycle. He actually could really relate to that. Yeah. And then to kind of just step back a little bit so that he could take exercise, but not too much. And I think like a lot of people, he used to do a lot of exercise.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I know anecdotally, you know, the people that you've worked with on this, I need to clarify, was that the second paramedic you talked about, were they through Frontline 19 as well?
Yeah.
So Frontline 19 is a wonderful organisation that was set up during the pandemic. For those of you who aren't aware of them, who offer therapy to people involved in frontline services. So that's why Jane is seeing a number of paramedics. It's not that they home in on her.
No.
So those referrals coming through Frontline 19, obviously.
Yeah. I enjoy my work with Frontline 19 a lot, I have to say. It's voluntary, but I get a lot out of it.
Yeah, and I think we have a number of human givens therapists who do volunteer through Frontline 19 as well, which is fantastic. And so in your experience, some people can make a full recovery. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we're so early on in this, really, aren't we? That there's so much, as I said earlier, there's so much we don't know, so much we don't understand about it. But and there'll always be exceptions to rule, and as to, you know, whatever else is going on for people as well. And it was interesting, wasn't it, that you mentioned that the lady had a lot of other
comorbid conditions
as well, which was what's come out in the evidence that we've seen today.
Yes, is that she has other conditions that have compounded the fatigue. And I wonder if it's a chicken egg thing, you know, because long COVID or COVID causes inflammation, and her other condition is an inflammatory condition. You know, but so it's a kind of they're each compounding the other. Yeah,
but you know, and in any case, working in the way that you've been working is obviously hugely, hugely beneficial. I guess in some cases where people have not yet found a way to manage their symptoms and to be feeling as if they are on that road to recovery, and it might just be the case that, you know, everybody's different, and they might just not have found the right strategy for them yet.
I think that is it, because it's a very individual journey. That some people will have more problems with their lungs, other people will have more brain fog, Other people have joint and muscle pain. You know, everybody will manifest the symptoms of long COVID very differently. Mm. And sometimes it's having the strength to argue with your GP. Yeah. And that's something that I've also found working, is that some doctors don't listen.
Mm. And I think
that's difficult. Yeah.
My own personal experience, my little boy had COVID, and he, after that, experienced about a year or just over a year of really severe digestive issues. Mm. And it was, we were just told by GP, oh yeah, that's common long COVID in children. And that was it. There was nowhere else to go with it. And he was clearly reacting to a number of different foods, and the school weren't happy to change or to provide him with, you know, the dietary requirements of school meals without an official dietitian diagnosis, which we couldn't get because it was just long COVID. So I can totally, and that was just a small thing, really. I mean, it was easy for us. We just sent him with a packed lunch that worked for him. But, you know, for other people, you know, out there, it must be such a challenge to try
and persuade your GP that there is something wrong with you. You know, at least long COVID is now recognised, that's one step in the right direction. But some people who have long COVID actually weren't unwell. You know, I know there is that in that latest study is that people who were severely unwell are more likely to get long COVID. But I do know people that are suffering from brain fog and joint pain and fatigue who had it very mildly.
Mm.
You know, so there's no, you know, you don't have to be on death's door to get long COVID. And I think some people might struggle to get a diagnosis of long COVID because they weren't really unwell.
They weren't unwell, they weren't hospitalised.
And
as we said, you know, it's obviously compounded by the consequences of quarantine and social isolation and, you know, complete change in lifestyle that was, you know, in many ways unable to help people to meet their needs. So I think there's so many complex things at play there, isn't it? Which is why the beauty of HG is that you know, we can draw it back to those physical needs, those emotional needs, helping people to access their life resources, their innate resources, and also to be able to add to them whilst acknowledging the barriers that they're experiencing as well.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you've spoken before about some of the implications of COVID leading to brain damage, even temporary brain damage.
Mm.
In some areas of the brain, which we know that damage to the internal guidance system being a huge barrier to people meeting their needs. So being able to work in that way, understanding that framework, such a useful, again, another map, isn't it, to help, you know, inform our understanding of what might benefit to our clients.
And there are people who will, you know, I think it's the microclots again, you know, it affects the lungs. And it affected the brains in a lot of people, you know, so that affects the way that you think, that affects the way, as you say, you get your needs met because your guidance system is damaged.
Mm. And so that the clots, is that because there was a starvation of oxygen to the brain, or is that something else?
I think it's probably it, like with the lungs, if you've got these teeny weeny little clots, it will prevent oxygen getting to some of the neurons, so they then die. There was a study that showed there was significant neuronal death in some people who had COVID and then leading on to long COVID, and these connections do kind of grow back again, but it takes a long time. You know, to build a new neuronal connection is not something that's instantaneous. It takes months. So, you know, foggy thinking or not seeing properly are things that are going to take time to repair.
Take time, having that understanding that on a, you know, on a neurological level, that takes time, but it is possible, again, is, you know, a huge reframe for people, isn't it?
Yeah, because they're in the here and now, which is scary and it's unknown. But like, if you can reframe it, that things change very gradually. You know, the one that I always think about is winter always turns into spring. You know, there's always hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess, you know, working in the way that you do is helping to provide an optimum environment for that neuronal repair.
Yeah. And I think that's where HG comes in, is because we consider the brain, don't we? We consider resources, and so we are aiding, if you like, that reconnection. Mm. And I'm quite sure that using guided imagery for some people is going to aid it even more. Or yeah, the use of language, you know, it's that sense of hope, and perhaps reminding people of resources that they've forgotten.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you know, in occupational therapy and other, you know, similar therapies, the use of the imagination has been used for a long time, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. I think it's called a light box or a mirror box. I might be wrong, but I'm a friend of mine who's an OT, something that she would use with people who'd lost mobility in one limb. She used this box and it made it look like the other limb was moving. And that was that neuronal repair. And we can be doing something very similar in guided imagery, in that imagination of using, exercising the imagination of that muscle, if you like. Mm. Yeah, absolutely fascinating,
isn't it?
And I think, you know, it's great to know that there are people like you out there working successfully with long COVID patients in order to help build that hope for them, that there is the capacity for change and improvement, and really helping them to understand that, you know, it's going at their own pace, just that's where they are right now. Jane, we've covered so much today. Is there anything else that you'd like to add at all?
No, yes. No, we've covered an awful lot. Yeah, I would like to state that I'm not an expert. I just have an interest, and I seem to get people with chronic fatigue, long COVID, fibromyalgia. They just seem to come my way. I don't call myself an expert.
No, but somebody with a lot of experience anyway.
Yeah, well, I think it's the personal experience gives you that way. You have a way of knowing where somebody might be coming from. It's the rapport element, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. That's brilliant. Jane, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your reflections and observations on your own work with long COVID patients. I'm sure our listeners will have found it really, really useful, whether that's for them on a personal level or a professional level, or maybe even both. If you would like to explore the Human Givens approach and the training we offer, you can find out more by visiting our website. And you can find the link for that in the podcast description, where you'll also find the links for many of the resources mentioned in this episode, as well as our podcast archive. We've been lucky enough to speak to so many interesting people on the Good Mental Health podcast and on such a wide range of topics. But if there's something that you would like us to cover, please do let us know. And of course, if you enjoyed listening today, please like, comment and share. But for now, thank you to everyone for listening. And until next time, goodbye.